Okay, I'm here with Mir, and we're going to talk about the Iran elections tonight, or today, sorry. So to start off with, give us a bit of an update on the elections, because I think in the last week or so there's been candidates who've dropped out, people who have endorsed, I think it was Rafsanjani today endorsed Rouhani, and so give us a quick update.
Sure. First of all, thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure and an honor to be speaking on your program tonight. In terms of the people who've dropped out, so far we see that Mr. Haddad Adel he dropped out. He didn't say for sake of whom. He didn't give his backing to anybody. But he was a member of the Conservative Usulgarayan. He dropped out of the race. And then today, that was 2 days ago, and today we saw Mr. Aref, who dropped out, and his support has gone to Mr. Rouhani. And Ayatollah Khatami and Ayatollah Rafsanjani have also given their support for Mr. Rouhani in order to help him win. Whether he will be allowed to win is another question. However, it goes to show that for once we see the Iranian reformists are actually getting their act together and uniting, which is quite new because they've usually been more divided. And even in the last election, we saw that the vote was divided between Karoubi and Mousavi, and they were together until the last moment. But I think the reformists and the moderates this time they are re-strategizing and they're going in with the single candidate, hoping that the sheer force and momentum behind that person is going to make it difficult for them to lose.
That's good. So, what all is at stake for the elections here? We hear in the United States a lot about the relationship between the president and the supreme leader, and sort of how this election is going to sort of define, that relationship. So, walk us through that. I mean, do you think this is, do you think this election is going to redefine the presidency in the sense that, power is going to be, more concentrated with the supreme leader and the president, the office of the president will become more vestigial and powerless. How does this dynamic work in this particular election?
Excuse me. These elections are first and foremost about the supreme leader. It's not about the president. It's about the supreme leader. It's about the legacy of the supreme leader, and it's about the office of the supreme leader. It's about the supreme leader consolidating his hold on the country. It's about the supreme leader finding somebody who's going to carry out his wishes in important fields such as the economy, such as foreign policy, and especially the nuclear program. It's about the supreme leader basically improving his influence and increasing his clout. The president, when the supreme leader looks for the president, he's not right now looking for somebody who's going to consolidate or strengthen the position of the office of the presidency. He's looking for somebody who's going to consolidate the position of the presidency as a subordinate to the supreme leader, first and foremost, and be one level underneath him, the Revolutionary Guard, and again one level underneath him, senior regime officials, which include people who work in the office of the supreme leader, and of course the senior members of the Guardian Council. So this is all about the supreme leader more than anything else, and how the president and the position of the president fits in within his hierarchy and within his the within the within the mechanisms that he manages the Islamic Republic of Iran. So this is mostly about him. I think that whether the president, the next president, depending on how he behaves, is going to convince the supreme leader whether there should be a president at all in the future. If, for example, the next president turns into another Ahmadinejad, which means that somebody who was very, very faithful in the beginning and then afterwards turned and bit the hand that fed, then I think the supreme leader will be convinced more and more to abolish the position of presidency in the future. However, if the supreme leader has a good experience, i.e., he has somebody in the office of the presidency who does what he's told, he's responsible, tasks can be delegated to him, and he gets things done, then I think that could actually convince the supreme leader not to to continue with the position of the presidency.
So where do we put the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard? I mean, if the election is about the supreme leader and his choice, where do we put, you know, the Revolutionary Guard? Do they affect the supreme leader's choice? You know, how do they affect the candidates? And, you know, how do they weigh in on the elections?
The position of the supreme leader, there are many differences, of course, between the office of the supreme leader and the IRGC, especially the position of the supreme leader and the Revolutionary Guard. There are many differences, one of them being that the Revolutionary Guard is not a monolithic body. It's not, you know, it's not one organization, one belief. No, there are many different trends of thought and beliefs in the Revolutionary Guard. There are people who support Ali Bhav. There are people, you know, it was revealed that the head of the Quds Force, Mr. Soleimani, supports Ali Bhav. I'm sure there are people, hardliners, who are within the Revolutionary Guard who are close to Ayatollah Mesbah Yazdi. They are supporting Saeed Jalili. I think, you know, there are different strands of the Revolutionary Guard. So when we say the Revolutionary Guard, I have to first of all crystallize what I mean. What I mean by the Revolutionary Guard is at the top echelon, which means probably, you know, Mr. Jaafari, who's the commander, and the head of the IRGC intelligence, Meysam Taib, and of course the head of the IRGC Quds Force, which is General Soleimani. I think generally their position is one that the next president, whether it's Jalili or Ali Bhav, has to first and foremost toe the supreme leader's line, but also, number two, has to have good relations with the IRGC, and especially be somebody who's not going to threaten their economic interests. I think to them this is even more important perhaps than the nuclear program. The IRGC is an economic body as well as being a military body, but it's also an economic body, and it has a lot of vested interest in Iran's economy, and having an increasingly monopolizing hold in different sectors. And they want somebody in the presidential office who's not going to disturb that, who's not going to meddle with that. But of course, it's somebody who is also going to back their worldview regarding the region, regarding the nuclear program. So I think they are important, but they come at number two behind what Ayatollah Khamenei says. And between the IRGC and Ayatollah Khamenei, it's Ayatollah Khamenei who has a veto.
So, you know, where do we put then, you know, sort of like the religious seminaries in Qom and in Mashhad and Esfahan? How do they affect the vote, and how do they affect this dynamic between the supreme leader, the president, and the IRGC? I mean, is their opinions on the presidential elections as varied as the IRGC, or, you know, where do we put the seminary schools and the sort of, you know, the ayatollahs and the religious class, the clerics?
If you and I were talking, if this was 1997, prior to the elections between Mr. Nader Nouri and Khatami, or in 2001, then I would say the position of the religious seminaries would be far higher. But what we've witnessed, especially from 2005 when Ahmadinejad was elected onwards, is what I call a silent revolution, a revolution upon which we didn't hear it. It wasn't in the streets, but yet it was a revolution because it changed slowly and gradually. Changed the format of the revolution, whereby the revolution started by seminaries in Qom, and it wasn't started. I mean, it was dreamt up in the seminaries of Qom, and then afterwards it was Ayatollah Khomeini went to Iraq and brought it to Iran, and you know the seminaries had a lot of power, but Khamenei slowly and gradually moved that away from moved power away from them since 2005, and now we see that actually the Islamic Revolution, its central power is not Qom anymore. And I think their important their opinion does count, but it's not anywhere near what it was before. So their opinion is important, but it's not crucial.
So let's sort of shift gears a little and talk about foreign policy. You know, what are the sort of you know, what is the main sort of foreign policy debate among the candidates? Is it, you know, does Syria come up? You know, does, you know, Iraq come up? Or, you know, do the, let me even ask this. Do the candidates even talk about foreign policy? I mean, is it an issue that is at stake, or is it more focused on domestic issues and, you know, the domestic economy?
First, please allow me to clarify one point. When I said the clerics don't matter, I mean, as a body, there are individual clerics, especially Ayatollah Mesbah Yazdi, who is one of the chief ideological centers, the center for Imam Khomeini, study of Imam Khomeini, research of Imam Khomeini that he has, where a lot of IRGC and Basij commanders get their ideological training. He's important, but as a body, I don't know a single body. For example, the Society for Combatant Clerics is not as, is, you know, it's their vote, as important as it is, not going to be as crucial. Is as crucial as the IRGC. So individually, there may be Ayatollahs there whose vote will be important, but as a body, their weight, religious seminaries don't have anywhere near the weight that they used to have. In terms of the foreign policy, one thing that's very notable in these debates, in the presidential debates, is the realization among the majority of the candidates that Iran's foreign policy is in trouble, diplomacy is not being used properly. You know, Syria, I can't remember a specific case where they discussed Syria apart from the fact that, you know, I heard Mr. Arif, reformist candidate Arif, saying that it's important that Syria is protected, Assad is protected, because if he falls, it could impact Iran. But generally, that what we've heard is that Iran's diplomatic position is falling, Iran's becoming isolated, and there was a fascinating, absolutely fascinating discussion regarding the nuclear program.
So walk us through that discussion then. I mean, it seems like here in the United States, you know, what we primarily focus on is the nuclear issue, right? So, yes. I mean, walk us through the sort of debates and, you know, what have the candidates been saying about the nuclear issue? And, you know, on the other side of that, what is notably absent? You know, what is notably not being discussed?
What is notably not being discussed is the fact that Saeed Jalili was getting beaten up metaphorically, of course, in the debates for his quote unquote nuclear policies and his, again, quote unquote nuclear diplomacy. But it's not his. This is not his. This is Ayatollah Khamenei's. So when people who are opposed to the current nuclear diplomacy and nuclear policies were criticizing Jalili, they were in a way criticizing Ayatollah Khamenei without mentioning his name. It's a Persian saying. We say "bedar migim ta divar veshnave," which means we tell the door so that the wall hears it. So, you know, they were doing the same. They were, you know, they were criticizing Jalili. Well, you know, they're criticizing Ayatollah Khamenei because Jalili, in a way, is just carrying out his orders. I think he believes what he does, but he's first and foremost, carrying out his orders. What was, I think, very interesting is that there was a recent report by NIAC saying that the narrative around the Supreme Leader has not changed. The sanctions have actually strengthened the narrative of resistance around the Supreme Leader. Well, these debates show the exact opposite of what NIAC report was saying. We saw that the head of the Supreme Leader's chief nuclear negotiator was at complete odds with the Supreme Leader's foreign policy advisor. The top man for Iran's foreign policy, for the Supreme Leader, was fighting it out with the top man for Iran's nuclear program, both of whom are the closest when it comes to foreign policy and nuclear policy to the Supreme Leader. They were fighting it out. There was a huge difference. Velayati, who is the Supreme Leader's advisor on the nuclear program, was basically lambasting Jalili by saying you haven't achieved anything by negotiating with the West. You just, you know, just going and reading out your position, that's not diplomacy. And, you know, he said that, you know, and things have been, there have been offers by the West, which some people have blocked. One of them was, of course, the Sarkozy in 2008, who wanted to meet Ayatollah Khamenei, and then Ahmadinejad stopped it. And why did he do that? Because Ahmadinejad was acting on the orders of Ayatollah Khamenei. It's almost impossible that Ahmadinejad would have the clout to block a meeting between Ayatollah Khamenei and Sarkozy on his own. So he was, you know, he was basically saying that. And there were other examples of, for example, Larry Jani, and also the Russians wanted to deal with the Iranians, and that was blocked. And, you know, and he was basically was having a go at Jalili by saying, you know, the Americans in the last round gave three different, they took three steps towards Iran, and you did not even take one step towards them. You can't expect them to take three steps and you nothing. You know, we also have to take a step, and you didn't take it. Which goes to show that actually President Obama's nuclear policy is very, very successful in that there are parts of the regime who are noticing that he's taking a slow, gradual steps towards Iran, but the regime is not reciprocating. And by regime, it means Khamenei is not reciprocating. And that Khamenei's position currently is being viewed as actually unreasonable by people within the regime. And I think this shows that there is deep divisions. I think President Obama's diplomacy and sanctions regime have created a lot of divisions within the regime. There are people within the regime who realize that there were opportunities for diplomacy, there were opportunities for a rapprochement with the West, but Ayatollah Khamenei didn't take him, and that's why there are sanctions now. Therefore, Iran missed an opportunity. And I think this is the most fascinating aspect of it, that there are, you know, it goes to show that President Obama has been very successful at reaching out to parts of the Iranian regime by, first and foremost, trying to reach a deal with them. And Sarkozy tried to reach a deal with them. And they see that it was Khamenei who wasn't interested, and which is why sanctions were imposed. And in fact, it was Iran who missed an opportunity. Or by Iran, I think, please let me rephrase that, Ayatollah Khamenei missed an opportunity.
So, you know, if, you know, you've spoken about Jalili and sort of him, but where do we put, you know, Rouhani? I thought, if I understand it correctly, Rouhani had written a book about nuclear diplomacy. I mean, where do we put him, and where do we, I mean, is he sort of critiquing, as you said, Jalili and by extension the Supreme Leader? Because where do we put, you know, his position and his experiences as sort of, if I understand it correctly, as a former nuclear negotiator, and then by extension, he's sort of, if I understand it correctly, he's written this book that is now not for sale anymore, but it's sort of critiqued, you know, the approach. I mean, walk us through, you know, Rouhani and what he, you know, what you see as his thoughts on the nuclear program.
Rouhani is the man who could save Iran's foreign policy. He's the only man available who could do it. I mean, Rafsanjani was the man. Well, actually, well, if you want to go that far, Mousavi would have been amazing for Iran nuclear foreign policy, but they didn't allow him. They didn't allow Rafsanjani because they're worried that he was going to win. And for the same reason, I don't think they'll allow Rouhani to win, because he wants basically to have a viable economy and a nuclear program. So, and by viable economy, he wants better relations with the West. And I think there is a strand within the Office of the Supreme Leader who believes that, you know, Iran must continue to build now. America cannot be trusted. That basically, you know, there is a thought, and I believe this is how the Supreme Leader sees it. The Supreme Leader sees peace with America as being far more dangerous than war. Peace could turn Iran, the Iranian regime may not be able to survive peace with the U.S., but as a war, it could survive it. I mean, an aerial war, perhaps not a full invasion, but perhaps, you know, bombardment, Iran can survive. But, you know, peace with America would take away one of the last vestiges of legitimacy which Khamenei has. And he's increasingly becoming alone in this. I think there are, even Ahmadinejad wanted better relations with the U.S. So, you know, when you have these people who want to go the isolationist route until they get to their goal, people like Rouhani is not in their interest. You know, Rouhani sounds like too much of a modernist to them. He's too much of a progressive. And, you know, it's he's that somebody that I think one of the things that I can say with more certainty than others is that they're not going to let him win. He wants to have a viable economy, and he knows that the only way to have a viable economy and a nuclear program is to reach a deal with the West. But currently, the Ayatollah Khamenei is not interested in that, and he believes, based on advice given to him, I don't know who gives him this advice, but somebody's giving him advice that it seems to me that the Europeans can't live without Iran's oil for a couple of more years. Just tough it out. In a couple of years, the Europeans are going to come and say to the EU3 that the oil sanctions that Iran is under is unfair. Our economies are suffering, so we want oil trade with Iran. So when they come crawling back to Iran, Iran can name its price and can say, I'll keep the centrifuges running. So the regime is under the impression that they're going to come back soon and, within 2 years. And I think this is the wrong strategy, but this is the strategy that the regime is going to pursue. And for now, they don't need somebody like Rouhani.
So, where does China fit into this? I mean, it seems like, if the regime's thinking is, in a couple of years, Europe will come back, the EU will come back and sort of start purchasing oil from Iran. Where do we put, China and sort of, Korea and Japan who do buy oil from Iran? I mean, is that factoring into sort of, Khamenei's thinking and sort of, the way that the regime approaches the nuclear strategy, the nuclear program?
Of course, I think it does. But for now, we see that the Koreans and the Chinese have reduced their oil purchases from Iran significantly. I mean, I think if I'm not mistaken, Korea is 50% and China is more than 25%. Their purchase of oil is important, but, it's not going to save. If the status quo continues for another couple of years, the amount of oil that China and Korea buy from Iran is not going to be sufficient to manage the economy. Some people say, yes, Iran can adapt and sell other products. Of course it can, but today the IRGC is a business interest. They want to have a good life. Are the IRGC going to be satisfied by selling potato sacks for $5 when they know they can sell oil at $110 a barrel? No. I think they'll want to sell oil. They're not going to be happy by selling potatoes and agricultural products at far lower price just for the sake of resistance in the long run. In the long run, I have to emphasize. So, Ayatollah Khamenei right now is hoping again that when the Europeans come crawling back, the Chinese and the Koreans are going to say, the Europeans are buying oil from Iran, so we're going to restore our purchase of oil from Iran to 100%. But again, I don't see that happening. I mean, especially with the Koreans, relationship with the U.S. is very important to them. And the Chinese, the Chinese have a very mercantile foreign policy. And if they can get the oil from Saudi Arabia to replace some of the oil they've lost from Iran, they'll continue to do so, and they'll just continue to play both sides.
So let's sort of shift. I'm curious because I think in our previous conversations on Iran, the issue of Israel doesn't really come up. And I guess my first question is, what is the view of Iran elections and Iran's foreign policy from Israel? Because I think here in the United States, we don't really get a good Israeli perspective. It's usually presented in extremes, and we don't get a good foreign policy discussion. So, what is the view from Israel of Iran, the elections and foreign policy and whatnot?
I don't think in Israel they're expecting a big change after Ahmadinejad goes. He's going to be missed by some in Israel because, the damage he caused to the Iranian regime by his irresponsible anti-Semitic attacks. If you want to question Israeli policy, that's fine. That's legitimate. That's everybody must question Israeli policy. That's a democratic right outside and Israel, inside Israel. That's no problem. But if you go and call the Holocaust a myth, then, you know, that's nothing to do with Israel. That's Jewish history. That's being anti-Semitic. And, you know, his anti-Semitic outbursts, as reprehensible as they were, basically did a far better job of isolating the Iranian regime than Israel ever could. So he's going to be missed in Israel because he did a great job for Israel in terms of isolating the Iranian regime and its nuclear program. In terms of who replaces him, I think, to be honest with you, whoever is going to change Iran's nuclear strategy is the person Israel prefers. If it's Rouhani going to do it by convincing Khamenei, then, you know, as they say in Arabic, Ahlan wa sahlan, may the force be with you. Or if it's Jalili who's going to do it by completely destroying Iran's economy with his lack of experience, then may the force be with him. So, you know, as far as the Israeli government is concerned, they just want this nuclear program right now in its current format stopped, IAEA to check Iran's nuclear program, for Iran to answer all of the questions to IAEA. And at the end, I think, you know, if once Iran gets a full clean bill of health, I see an increasing consensus in Israel for limited enrichment in Iran, which, you know, under strict IAEA's inspection, which would be fine. You know, Iran can hold enough enriched uranium to make electricity, and, you know, for medical purposes, and here in Israel they can sleep sound in the knowledge that the regime is not going after a bomb. But that's a long way from now. They just want, you know, whoever is going to do it, if it's going to be Rouhani or Jalili, they don't care as long as somebody does this, because it's quite a concern in Israel. Although I must say that what is happening in Syria is pushing Iran a little bit out of the news.
So I'm curious then. It's, you know, you made mention that Israel could potentially, you know, there's certain parts in Israel that could live with limited enrichment. But I'm curious then, you know, before we get to limited enrichment, you know, where does the debate stand in terms of striking Iran? Is this something that sort of, is this something that's discussed and
not
sort
anymore.
Of debated?
Not anymore. Not anymore. Not anymore. Not anymore. I mean, of course, it's discussed, but not in anywhere near the way it was before last year. Last year, sometimes you wake up in the morning and think, "Oh my God, what's going to happen?" Because at some time, sometimes it was really, you know, it was getting close to the bone, you know. And we saw that Netanyahu almost started a war. But now it's, you know, I think in Israel there's two factors which has calmed the nerves. Number one is Obama. I think more and more people here believe that he genuinely is going to stop Iran's nuclear program. And number two is that the Iranian regime is putting some of its enriched uranium beyond use for a bomb by converting it to nuclear fuel. Of course, it could be reconverted back, but it would take 3 weeks. But nevertheless, it shows that the regime is trying to reduce tension, and I think it's been noticed in Israel in a good way.
So then, you know, in terms of Israeli sort of strategic thinking, I mean, is, you know, what is the view of Israel, of Iran's sort of involvement in Lebanon and Syria? I mean, is this, you know, is Hezbollah and sort of Iran's support of the Assad regime, is this something that is viewed as separate from the nuclear program, or is this, or, you know, is, you know, the Israeli view of Iranian foreign policy all lumped into one, you know, one sort of big issue? You know, or does it, you know, walk us through, I mean, is there a bit of disaggregation and sort of viewing everything on its own merits?
Well, I think the concern is it's when it comes to Syria, Iran's role in Syria and Iran's nuclear program, the only concern here, I think, is, you know, if you weaken Iran in Syria, then you can weaken its hand in the nuclear program. But Israel is in a dilemma because actually Bashar al-Assad is better than these al-Qaeda people in Syria. So in a way, actually, Assad is okay. You know, Israel prefers far more fighting extreme Shiites than extreme Sunnis, because if you compare the number of attacks against civilians, extremist Sunnis are target civilians far more than extremist Shiites. Israel, choosing between the two, Israel would, between, you know, Al-Qaeda movements and Hezbollah, Israel would choose Hezbollah any day. Between, you know, Al-Qaeda leaders and Bashar al-Assad, Israel would choose Bashar al-Assad any day. So Israel is in a bit of a dilemma. But, you know, there's also the, I think there should be concern that, you know, Iran is going to be part of the solution in Syria. Like it or not, Iran should be included in the conference for Syria, which they're trying to set up. But I think we have to be careful to make sure that Iran doesn't extract, when I say Iran, of course, I mean the Iranian regime, doesn't extract any concessions because of its influence in Syria from the West over its nuclear program. They have to be separate. The West has to open up a separate account in Syria and not to give discount for Iran's nuclear program. The accounts have to be separate, and whatever happens in each account should be kept separate. And I think this is the main. I think this should be the main concern about any involvement of Iran in future talks for Syria. But I think in the long run, if Iran can actually bring a bit of stability back to Syria, then I think that would actually be in the interest of Israel.
So I wanted to sort of go back and ask you, I mean, do Israelis view sanctions, you know, U.S. imposed sanctions and U.S. foreign policy in general as successful then? Because I meant to follow up with this because it seems like, you know, I think in the United States, our press, you know, seems to pick up on, you know, divisions between Israel and the United States, but you've made this, you know, you made this really good point that really it's, you know, the foreign policy and sort of the two countries are sort of more in line than separate. So, I mean, walk us through this. I mean, in Israel, you know, is the view, you know, are sanctions working? You know, do they agree with sanctions? So forth, so on.
I think in Israel, the view is let's scare the bejesus out of Iran wherever you get the chance with military action so that they agree to answer IAEA questions. So, you know, in Israel, I think part of the reason why the government keeps saying sanctions are not working is because they want to scare the Iranian regime. Because they want to say, well, look, we don't think sanctions are working, so America should attack you. And so, you know, we are pressuring America to attack you, so you better negotiate with the United States. This is, I think, part of the Israeli strategy. You know, I don't think anybody in Israel is under the impression that sanctions are going to work within a year. If they are, then they are sorely mistaken. Sanctions are not going to work within 1 year. But, you know, I think right now that the reason why they are saying that sanctions are not working is because they want to put pressure on Iran. And I think the Iranian regime makes the mistake of worrying far more, you know, about whether Israel is going to attack than sanctions. An Israeli attack is going to be military setback. Iran can recover from it in 5 years, 10 years, 2 years, who knows. But sanctions, the damage that sanctions are causing within the regime, just look at the way they're going at it. Ayatollah Khamenei's top two men, nuclear, Jalili and Velayati. Look at what's going on. Look at what's happening to the economy. This is far more dangerous than an Israeli attack. You know, the regime not being able to, you know, the rial falling, this is dangerous. So, you know, I think, you know, the regime is also looking at the wrong thing. You know, the regime should focus more, far more on its own economy and the damage which its nuclear policies are causing to it than whether Israel is going to attack or not.
That's a good point. So, so basically we've sort of reached the end of our conversation. I mean, I always like to give my guest the last sort of view or the last, you know, the last point. So, you know, give us a sort of closing thought, a sort of thought that sort of encapsulates everything that we've talked about today.
Well, I'll tell you the way, if I may, I just say, you know, my view. I think Iran has a right to have a nuclear program. Iran has a right to enrich uranium. Iran needs a nuclear program. You know, the demand for electricity in Iran is increasing every year by 7 to 8%. And young people, especially my generation and the generation before me, are getting married and they are setting up families, which increases demand for energy. But I think right now the biggest problem we have with Iran's nuclear program is that it's being managed by an unelected group of people who've hijacked it for their own purposes, who are using it for their own benefit rather than the benefit of the people of Iran. And I think this is one of the biggest challenges that we're facing today. And, you know, I think the best way to look at Iran's nuclear program is what it can be likened to is it's Boucher reactor. the current Iranian nuclear policy can best be described, likened to the Bushehr nuclear reactor. It's backwards. It's way over it, the price it should be. It's overpriced and it's dysfunctional. It keeps breaking down and it's difficult to justify. And this is what happens when you have unelected people managing national projects for their own benefit. And I think this is the biggest shame. I think this is the biggest shame because Iran needs to have a nuclear program. Iran should have a nuclear program for civilian purposes. But our biggest challenge is that we are dealing with a group of unelected people who are not answerable to anybody in Iran. And I think this is the biggest challenge. And until that issue is solved, we have to continue with the diplomacy. Unfortunately, sanctions are there not because anybody wants them, because there's no other way. But I think it's extremely important that you and I and all other Iranians pressure governments around the world to make sure that the sale of medicine and food is not blocked to Iran, which it's not. But, you know, that companies don't have fear to sell medicine and food to Iran and hope that, you know, soon we're going to see an agreement between these two sides and that people of Iran get the energy they need and they deserve. And we in Israel know that the regime who has called for our elimination and has denied our history and the biggest massacre in our history does not get a nuclear weapon.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.